This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. Written by Nir Eyal with Julie Lee. Performed by Nir Eyal.
An important note. Before you start listening, please make sure to download the supplementary materials from my website. You'll find free resources, downloads, and my latest updates at indistractable.com. Now remember, Nir is spelt like my first name, N-I-R, so that's nirandfar.com/indistractable. Most important, you'll want to use the accompanying workbook, which I designed with exercises for each and every chapter, to help you apply what you learned to your own life. Also, please note that I do not have any financial interest at any of the companies mentioned unless specifically stated, and my recommendations are not influenced by any advertisers. If you'd like to get in touch personally, you can reach me through my blog at nearandfar.com/contact. Introduction. From Hooked to Indistractable. There's a certain yellow book you'll find on the shelves of most major tech companies. I've seen it at Facebook, Google, PayPal, and Slack. It's given out at tech conferences and company training events. A friend working at Microsoft told me the CEO, Satya Nadella, held up a copy and recommended it to all of the company's employees. The book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, was a Wall Street Journal bestseller and, at the time of this writing, still ranks as the number one book in the products category on Amazon. It's a cookbook of sorts. The book contains a recipe for human behavior, your behavior. These tech companies know that in order to make money, they need to keep us coming back. Their business models depend on it. I know this because I've spent the past decade researching the hidden psychology that some of the most successful companies in the world use to make their products so captivating. For years, I taught future executives at both the Stanford Graduate School of Business and at the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. In writing Hooked, my hope was that startups and socially concerned companies would use this knowledge to design new ways of helping people build better habits. Why should the tech giants keep these secrets to themselves? Shouldn't we use the same psychology that makes video games and social media so engaging to design products to help people live better lives? Since Hooked was published, thousands of companies have used the book to empower their users to build helpful and healthy habits. Fitbod is a fitness app that helps people build better exercise routines. Bite Food seeks to change people's eating habits with internet-connected pantries that offer locally made fresh meals. Kahoot builds software to make classroom learning more engaging and fun. In fact, I love the way Kahoot and Bite Foods used my book so much that I decided to invest in both companies. We want our products to be user-friendly, easy to navigate, and yes, even habit-forming. Companies making their products more engaging isn't necessarily a problem, it's progress. But of course, there's a dark side. As philosopher Paul Virilio wrote, "When you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck." In the case of user-friendly products and services, what makes some products so engaging and easy to use can also make them distracting. For many people, these distractions can get out of hand, leaving us with a feeling that our decisions are not our own. The fact is, in this day and age, if you are not equipped to manage distraction, your brain will be manipulated by time-wasting diversions. In the next few minutes, I'll reveal my own struggle with distraction and how I, ironically, got hooked. But I'll also share how I overcame my struggle and explain why we are much more powerful than any of the tech giants. As an industry insider, I know their Achilles heel, and soon you will too. The good news is that we have the unique ability to adapt to such threats. We can take steps right now to retrain and regain our brains. To be blunt, what other choice do we have? We don't have time to wait for regulators to do something. And if you hold your breath waiting for corporations to make their products less distracting, well, you're going to suffocate. In the future, there will be two kinds of people in the world. Those who let their attention and lives be controlled and coerced by others, and those who proudly call themselves indistractable. By listening to this audiobook, you've taken the first step towards owning your time and your future. But you're just getting started. For years, you've been conditioned to expect instant gratification. Think of finishing this audiobook as a personal challenge to liberate your mind. The antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. Planning ahead ensures you will follow through. With the techniques in this book, you'll learn exactly what to do from this day forth to control your attention and choose your life. Chapter 1. What's your superpower? I love sweets. I love social media. And I love television. However, as much as I love these things, they don't love me back. Overeating a sugary indulgence after a meal, spending too much time scrolling a feed, or indulging in a Netflix binge until 2 a.m. were all things I once did with little or no conscious thought, out of habit. Just as eating too much junk food leads to health problems, the overuse of devices can also have negative consequences. For me, it was the way I prioritized distractions over the most important people in my life. Worst of all was what I let distractions do to my relationship with my daughter. She's our only child and, to my wife and me, the most amazing kid in the world. On one particular day, the two of us were playing games from an activity book designed to bring dads and daughters closer together. The first activity involved naming each other's favorite things. The next project was building a paper airplane with one of the pages. The third was a question we both had to answer. The question was, if you could have any superpower, what would it be? I wish I could tell you what my daughter said at that moment, but I can't. I have no idea, because I wasn't really there. I was physically in the room, but my mind was elsewhere. "Daddy," she said, "what would your superpower be?" "Huh?" I grunted. "Just a second. I just need to respond to this one thing." I dismissed her as I attended to something on my phone. My eyes were still glued to my screen, fingers tapping away at something that seemed important at the time, but could definitely have waited. She went quiet. By the time I looked up, she was gone. I had just blown a magical moment with my daughter because something on my phone had grabbed my attention. On its own, this was no big deal. But if I told you that this was an isolated incident, I'd be lying. This same scene had played out countless times before. I wasn't the only one putting distractions before people. An early reader of this book told me that when he asked his 8-year-old daughter what her superpower would be, she said she wanted to talk to animals. When asked why, the child said, "So that I have someone to talk to when you and mommy are too busy working on your computers." After finding my daughter and apologizing, I decided it was time for a change. At first, I went extreme. Convinced it was all technology's fault, I tried a digital detox. I started using an old-school flip phone so I couldn't be tempted to use email, Instagram, and Twitter. But I found it too difficult to get around without GPS and the addresses saved inside my calendar app. I missed listening to audiobooks while I walked, as well as all the other handy things my smartphone could do. To avoid wasting time reading too many news articles online, I purchased a subscription to the print edition of a newspaper. A few weeks later, I had a stack of unread papers piled neatly next to me as I watched the news on TV. In an attempt to stay focused while writing, I bought a 1990s word processor without an internet connection. However, whenever I'd sit down to write, I'd find myself glancing at the bookshelf and would soon start flipping through books unrelated to my work. Somehow, I kept getting distracted, even without the tech that I thought was the source of the problem. You see, removing online technology didn't work. I just replace one distraction with another. In writing this book, I discovered that living the life we want requires not only doing the right things, it also requires we stop doing the wrong things that take us off track. We all know eating cake is worse for our waistline than having a healthy salad. We agree that aimlessly scrolling our social media feeds is not as enriching as spending time with real friends in real life. We understand that if we want to be more productive at work, we need to stop wasting time and actually do the work. We already know what to do. What we don't know is how to stop getting distracted. In researching and writing this book over the past 5 years, and by following the science-backed methods you'll soon learn, I'm now more productive, physically and mentally stronger, better rested, and more fulfilled in my relationships than I've ever been. This book is about what I learned as I developed the most important skill of the 21st century, It's about how I became indistractable and how you can too. The first step is to recognize that distraction starts from within. In part one, you'll learn practical ways to identify and manage the psychological discomfort that leads us off track. However, I want you to know that I steer clear of recommending well-worn techniques like mindfulness and meditation. While these methods can be effective for some people, they have already been written about ad nauseum. If you're listening to this audiobook, my guess is you've already tried those techniques and, like me, found they didn't quite do the trick for you. Instead, we'll take a fresh look at what really motivates our behavior and learn why time management is pain management. We'll also explore how to make just about any task enjoyable. Now, not in the Mary Poppins way of adding a spoonful of sugar, but by cultivating the ability to focus intensely on what we are doing. Part two will look at the importance of making time for the things you really want to do. You'll learn why you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it is distracting you from. You'll learn to plan your time with intention, even if you choose to spend it scrolling through celebrity headlines or reading a steamy romance novel. After all, the time you plan to waste is not wasted time. Part three follows with a no-holds-barred examination of the unwanted external triggers that hamper our productivity and diminish our well-being. While technology companies use cues like the pings and dings on our phones to hack our behavior, external triggers are not confined to our digital devices. They're all around us, from cookies beckoning when we open the kitchen cabinet to a chatty coworker keeping us from finishing that time-sensitive project. Part four holds the last key to making you indistractable: pacts. While removing external triggers is helpful in keeping distractions out, pacts are a proven way of reining ourselves in, ensuring we do what we say we're going to do. In this part, we'll apply the ancient practice of pre-commitment to modern challenges. Finally, we'll take an in-depth look at how to make your workplace indistractable, raise indistractable kids, and foster indistractable relationships. These final chapters will show you how to regain lost productivity at work, have more satisfying relationships with your friends and family, and even be a better lover, all by conquering distraction. You're welcome to navigate the four steps to becoming indistractable however you like, but I recommend you proceed in order through part one to four. The four modalities build on each other, with the first step being the most foundational. If you're the kind of person who likes to learn by example, and you want to see the tactics in action first, feel free to skip ahead to parts five and on, then come back through the first four parts for a deeper explanation. Also, there's no requirement to adopt each and every technique right away. Some might not fit your current situation and only become useful in the future when you're ready or your circumstances change. But I promise you that by the time you finish listening to this book, you will discover several breakthroughs that will change the way you manage distraction forever. Imagine for a moment the incredible power of following through on your intentions. How much more effective would you be at work? How much more time could you spend with your family or doing the things you love? How much happier would you be? What would your life be like if your superpower was being indistractable? At the end of each chapter, I'm going to give you a few bullet points to remember in what I call the Remember This section. Now, if you want to see these written out, you can download my 80-page workbook, totally complimentary, at indistractable.com. Here's what I want you to remember for this chapter. We need to learn how to avoid distraction. Living the lives we want not only requires doing the right things, but also necessitates not doing the things we know we'll regret. The problem is deeper than tech. Being indistractable isn't about being a Luddite. It's about understanding the real reasons why we do things against our best interests. Here's what it takes. We can be indistractable by learning and adopting four key strategies. Chapter 2. Being Indistractable. The ancient Greeks immortalized the story of a man who was perpetually distracted. We call something that is desirable but just out of reach tantalizing after his name. The story goes that Tantalus was banished to the underworld by his father Zeus as a punishment. There he found himself wading in a pool of water while a tree dangled ripe fruit above his head. The curse seems benign, but when Tantalus tried to pluck the fruit, the branch moved away from him, always just out of reach. When he bent down to drink the cool water, it receded away so that he could never quench his thirst. Tantalus's punishment was to yearn for things he desired, but could never grasp. You have to hand it to the ancient Greeks for their allegories. It's hard to portray a better representation of the human condition. We are constantly reaching for something. More money, more experiences, more knowledge, more status, more stuff. The ancient Greeks thought this was just part of the curse of being a fallible mortal and used the story to portray the power of our incessant desires. Traction and distraction. Imagine a line that represents the value of everything you do throughout your day. To the right, the actions are positive. To the left, they are negative. On the right side of the continuum is traction, which comes from the Latin trahere, meaning to draw or pull. You can think of traction as the actions that draw us towards what we want in life. On the left side is distraction, the opposite of traction. Derived from the same Latin root, the word means drawing away of the mind. Distractions impede us from making progress towards the life we envision. All behaviors, whether they tend towards traction or distraction, are prompted by triggers, internal or external. Internal triggers cue us from within. When we feel our belly growl, we look for a snack. When we're cold, we find a coat to warm up. And when we're sad, lonely, or stressed, we might call a friend or loved one for support. External triggers, on the other hand, are cues in our environment that tell us what to do next. Like the pings, dings, rings, and other things that prompt us to check our emails, open a news alert, or answer a phone call. External triggers can also take the form of other people, such as a coworker who stops by our desk. They can also be objects, like a television set whose mere presence urges us to turn it on. Whether prompted by internal or external triggers, the resulting action is either aligned with our broader intentions and is therefore traction, or misaligned and is a distraction. Traction helps us accomplish our goals. Distraction leads us away from them. The challenge, of course, is that our world has always been full of things designed to distract us. Today, people find themselves attached to their mobile phones, but they are only the latest potential hindrance. People complained about the brain-melting power of television since its very inception. Before that, it was the telephone, comic books, and the radio. Even the written word was blamed for creating, quote, forgetfulness in the learner's souls, according to Socrates. Though some of these things seem dull in comparison to today's enticements, distractions have and always will be facts of life. Today's distractions, however, feel different. The amount of information available, the speed at which it can be disseminated, and the ubiquity of access to new content on our devices has made for a trifecta of distraction. If it's distraction you seek, it's easier than ever to find. What's the cost of all that distraction? In 1971, the psychologist Herbert A. Simon presciently wrote, quote, "The wealth of information means a dearth of something else, a poverty of attention." Researchers tell us attention and focus are the raw materials of human creativity and flourishing. In the age of increased automation, the most sought-after jobs are those that require creative problem-solving, novel solutions, and the kind of human ingenuity that comes from focusing deeply on the task at hand. Socially, we see that close friendships are the bedrock of psychological and physical health. Loneliness, according to researchers, is more dangerous than obesity. But of course, we can't cultivate close friendships if we're constantly distracted. Consider our children. How can they flourish if they can't concentrate long enough to apply themselves? What example are we setting for them if our loving faces are replaced by the tops of our heads as we constantly stare into our screens? Let's think back to the tale of Tantalus. What was his curse, exactly? Was it never-ending hunger and thirst? Not really. What would have happened to Tantalus if he had just stopped reaching? He was already in hell, after all, and dead people don't need food and water, last time I checked. The curse is not that Tantalus spends all eternity reaching for things just out of reach, but rather his obliviousness to the greater folly of his actions. Tantalus's curse was his blindness to the fact he didn't need those things in the first place. That's the real moral of the story. Tantalus's curse is also our curse. We are compelled to reach for things we supposedly need, but really don't. We don't need to check our email right this second, or need to see the latest trending news, no matter how much we feel we must. Fortunately, unlike Tantalus, we can step back from our desires, recognize them for what they are, and do something about them. We want companies to innovate and solve our evolving needs, yet we must also ask whether better products bring out our best selves. Distractions will always exist. Managing them is our responsibility. Being indistractable means striving to do what you say you will do. Indistractable people are as honest with themselves as they are with others. If you care about your work, your family, and your physical and mental well-being, you must learn how to become indistractable. The 4-part indistractable model is a tool for seeing and interacting with the world in a brand new way. It will serve as your map for controlling your attention and choosing your life. Remember this. Distraction stops you from achieving your goals. It is any action that moves you away from what you really want. Traction leads you closer to your goals. It is any action that moves you toward what you really want. Triggers prompt both traction and distraction. External triggers prompt you to action with cues in your environment. Internal triggers prompt you to action with cues within you. Part 1. Master Internal Triggers. Chapter 3. What motivates us, really? Zoe Chance, a professor at the Yale School of Management with a doctorate from Harvard, made a shocking revelation to a crowded TEDx audience. She said, "I'm coming clean today, telling this story for the very first time in its raw, ugly detail. In March of 2012, I purchased a device that would slowly begin to ruin my life." At Yale, Chance taught future executives the secrets of changing consumer behavior. Despite the class's title, Mastering Influence and Persuasion, Chance's confession revealed that she herself was not immune to manipulation. What began as a research project turned into mindless compulsion. Chance stumbled upon a product that typified many of the persuasion techniques she taught in her class. She tells me, "We kept saying, 'Oh, wow, this is brilliant. These guys are geniuses. They've actually used every motivational tool we could possibly think of.'" Naturally, Chance had to try it out for herself and signed up to be the first guinea pig in her research experiment. Little did she know how the product would manipulate her mind and body. She says, "I really, really, truly could not stop. And it took me a long time to realize it was a problem," she says now. It's easy to understand why Chance stayed in denial for so long. The product she became dependent upon was not a prescription pill or some street drug. It was a pedometer. More specifically, it was the Strive smart pedometer made by a Silicon Valley startup founded just 1 year earlier. Chance is quick to mention that the Strive is no ordinary pedometer. She says, quote, "They market it as a personal trainer in your pocket," she says. "But no, 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 it is Satan in your pocket." As a company founded by former video game designers, Strive utilizes behavioral design tactics to compel customers to be more physically active. Users of the pedometer are tasked with challenges as they accrue points for walking. They can compete with other players and view their relative ranking in tournament-style leaderboards. The company also couples the step counter with a smartphone app called Myland, where players can exchange points to build virtual worlds online. Clearly, these tricks had cast their spell on Chance. In fact, she found herself incessantly pacing to keep accumulating steps and points. Quote, "I would come home, and while I was eating, or while I was reading, or while I was eating and reading at the same time, or while my husband was trying to talk to me, I'd be going in this circuit between the living room and the kitchen and the dining room, the living room and the kitchen and the dining room." Unfortunately, all that walking, much of it in circles, started taking its toll. She had less time for her family and friends. Quote, "The only people that I was getting closer to," she admits, "was my colleague Ernest, who also had a Strive. So we would set challenges and compete with each other." Chance was obsessed. Quote, I was creating spreadsheets to optimize and track, not my exercising, but my virtual transactions in a virtual world that existed on a Strive device. Her obsession was not only sucking time away from her work and her other priorities, but also began to cause her physical harm. Quote, when I was using the Strive, I was going 24,000 steps a day. You do the math. Chance recalls how at the end of one particularly active day, she received a tempting offer from her Strive. Quote, it was midnight and I was brushing my teeth and getting ready for bed. When this pop-up challenge showed up, it said, we'll give you triple points if you just climb 20 stairs. Chance quickly realized that she could complete the challenge in about a minute by walking down and up her basement staircase twice. After completing the challenge, she received another message, encouraging her to climb another 40 steps for triple points. She thought, yes, of course, it's a good deal, and quickly walked an additional 4 flights. The incessant walking did not stop there. For the next 2 hours, from midnight until 2 in the morning, the professor treaded up and down her basement staircase as if possessed by some strange mind-controlling power. When she finally did come to a standstill, she realized she had climbed over 2,000 stairs. That's more than the 1,872 required to climb the Empire State Building. As she walked up and down her stairs in the middle of the night, she felt unable to stop. Under the influence of the Strive smart pedometer, Chance had turned into a fitness zombie. On the surface, Chance's story is a textbook case study of how something as seemingly helpful as a pedometer can mutate into a harmful distraction. Once I'd learned about Chance's strange obsession with her fitness tracker, I wanted to know more. But first, I needed to better understand what really drove her behavior. For hundreds of years, we believe that motivation is driven by reward and punishment. As Jeremy Bentham, the English philosopher and founder of utilitarianism, put it, quote, nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. The reality, however, is that motivation has much less to do with pleasure than was once thought. Even when we think we are seeking pleasure, we're actually driven by the desire to free ourselves from the pain of wanting. Epicurus, the ancient Greek philosopher, said it best, quote, by pleasure, we mean the absence of pain in the body and of trouble in the soul. Simply put, the drive to relieve discomfort is the root cause of all our behavior, while everything else is a proximate cause. Consider the game of pool. What makes the colored balls go into the pockets? Is it the white cue ball, the stick, or the player's actions? We understand that while the white cue ball and stick are necessary, the root cause is the player. The white cue ball and stick aren't the root causes. They are the proximate causes of the resulting event. In the game of life, it's often hard to see the root cause of things. When we're passed over for a promotion, we might blame that cunning coworker for taking our job instead of reflecting on our lack of qualifications and initiative. When we get into a fight with our spouse, we might blame the conflict on one tiny incident, like a toilet seat left up, instead of acknowledging years of unresolved issues. And when we scapegoat our political and ideological opponents for the world's troubles, we choose not to seek to understand the deeper systemic reasons behind the problems. These proximate causes have something in common. They help us deflect responsibility onto something or someone else. It's not that the cue ball and stick don't factor into the equation, just like the coworker or toilet seat, but they certainly aren't entirely responsible for the outcome. Without understanding and tackling root causes, we're stuck being helpless victims in a tragedy of our own creation. The distractions in our lives are the result of the same forces. They are proximate causes that we think are to blame, while the root causes stay hidden. We tend to blame things like television, junk food, social media, cigarettes, and video games, but these are all proximate causes of our distraction. Solely blaming a smartphone for causing distraction is just as flawed as blaming a pedometer for making someone climb too many stairs. Unless we deal with the root causes of our distraction, we'll continue to find ways to distract ourselves. Distraction, it turns out, isn't about the distraction itself. Rather, it's about how we respond to it. Over several email exchanges, Zoe Chance let me in on a dark truth that drove her extreme behaviors, which she hadn't revealed in her TEDx talk. Quote, "My addiction to Strive coincided with one of the most stressful periods in my life," she tells me. "I was just going on the job market to look for a job as a rookie marketing professor, a grueling, months-long process involving tremendous uncertainty," she continues. "It's not uncommon for academics on the job market to experience physical symptoms of stress. I was losing hair, losing sleep, and getting heart palpitations. I felt like I was going crazy, and I had to hide it from everyone." Chance was also hiding a secret about her marriage. Her husband was a marketing professor too, which meant that the couple needed to find a joint appointment, either for her at his school or both of them at another school. Quote, "Marketing departments are small and joint appointments rare as hen's teeth." Further complicating matters, her marriage was falling apart. Quote, "I didn't know whether my husband and I would be together or not. But because the best case scenario would be that we worked things out, stayed married, and I got a job at his university, we didn't want anyone at his university to know we might get divorced, since then they'd be less likely to offer me a job." Chance felt stuck. Quote, "I knew that even my best efforts couldn't guarantee a good outcome for either my marriage or the job market. And in hindsight, I can see that Strive gave me something I could control and succeed at." During this particularly difficult time in her life, she says she used her Strive as a coping device. Quote, "It was an escape from reality," she now admits. Most people don't want to acknowledge the uncomfortable truth that distraction is always an unhealthy escape from reality. How we deal with uncomfortable internal triggers determines whether we pursue healthy acts of traction or self-defeating distraction. For Chance, racking up Strive points provided the escape she was looking for. For other people, the escape comes from checking social media, spending more time in the office, watching television, or in some case, drinking or taking hard drugs. If you're trying to escape the pain of something as serious as an impending divorce, the real problem is not your pedometer. Without dealing with the discomfort driving our desire for escape, we'll continue to resort to one distraction or another. Only by understanding our pain can we begin to control it and find better ways to deal with negative urges. Fortunately, Chance was able to come to this realization herself. First, she focused on the real source of discomfort in her life, narrowing in on the internal triggers she was trying to escape. Though she did end up separating from her husband, she says she's in a much better place in her life now. Professionally, she got a full-time post at Yale, where she still teaches today. She has also found better ways to stay healthy and in control of her time, scheduling regular fitness activities instead of letting her pedometer rule over her. Though overcoming her obsession was a positive step for Chance, the Strive pedometer wouldn't be the last distraction in her life. But by pinpointing the root cause rather than blaming the proximate, she'll be better able to address the real issues next time. When used together, the strategies and techniques you're about to learn in this section work both immediately and for the long term. Remember this. Understand the root cause of distraction. Distraction is about more than our devices. Separate proximate causes from the root cause. All motivation is a desire to escape discomfort. If a behavior was previously effective at providing relief, we're likely to continue using it as a tool to escape discomfort. Anything that stops discomfort is potentially addictive, but that doesn't make it irresistible. If you know the drivers of your behavior, you can take steps to manage them. Chapter 4. Time management is pain management. At first, I didn't want to believe the inconvenient truth behind what really drives distraction. But after digesting the scientific literature, I had to face the fact that the motivation for diversion originates within us. As is the case with all human behavior, distraction is just another way our brains attempt to deal with pain. If we accept this fact, it makes sense that the only way to handle distraction is by learning to handle discomfort. If distraction costs us time, then time management is pain management. But where does our discomfort come from? Why are we perpetually restless and unsatisfied? We live in the safest, healthiest, most well-educated, most democratic time in human history, and yet some part of the human psyche causes us to constantly look for an escape from things stirring inside us. As the 18th century poet Samuel Johnson said, quote, "My life is one long escape from myself." Mine too, brother, mine too. Thankfully, we can take solace in knowing we are hardwired for this sort of dissatisfaction. Sorry to say, but odds are you and I are never going to be fully happy with our lives. Sporadic bouts of joy? Sure. An occasional feeling of euphoria? Yes. Singing Happy by Pharrell Williams in your underwear once in a while? Okay, who hasn't? But the sustained, happily ever after sort of satisfaction you see in the movies? Forget about it. It's a myth. That sort of happiness is designed to never last for long. Eons of evolution gave you and me a brain in a near constant state of discontentment. We're wired this way for a simple reason. As a study published in the Review of General Psychology notes, quote, "If satisfaction and pleasure were permanent, there might be little incentive to continue seeking further benefits or advances." In other words, feeling contented wasn't good for the species. Our ancestors worked harder and strove further because they evolved to be perpetually perturbed, and so we remain today. Unfortunately, the same evolutionary traits that helped our kin survive by driving them to constantly do more can conspire against us today. Four psychological factors make satisfaction temporary. Let's begin with the first factor, boredom. The lengths people go to avoid boredom is shocking, sometimes literally. A 2014 study published in Science asked participants to sit in a room and think for 15 minutes. The room was empty except for a device that allowed the participants to mildly but painfully electrocute themselves. Why would anyone want to do that, you might ask? When asked beforehand, every participant in the study said they would pay to avoid being shocked. However, when left alone in the room with the machine and nothing else to do, 67% of men and 25% of women shocked themselves. And many did so multiple times. The study's authors conclude their paper by saying, quote, "People prefer doing to thinking, even if what they are doing is so unpleasant that they normally would pay to avoid it. The untutored mind does not like to be alone with itself." It's no surprise, therefore, that most of the top 25 websites in America sell escape from our daily drudgery, whether through shopping, celebrity gossip, or bite-sized doses of social interaction. The second psychological factor driving us to distraction is negativity bias, quote, "a phenomenon in which negative events are more salient and demand attention more powerfully than neutral or positive events." As the author of one study concluded, quote, "it appears to be a basic, pervasive fact of psychology that bad is stronger than good." Such pessimism begins very early in life. Babies begin to show signs of negativity bias starting at just 7 months of age, suggesting this tendency is inborn. As further evidence, researchers believe we tend to have an easier time recalling bad memories than good ones. Studies have found people are more likely to recall unhappy moments in their childhood, even if they would describe their upbringing as being generally happy. Negativity bias almost certainly gave us an evolutionary edge. Good things are nice, but bad things can kill you, which is why we pay attention to and remember the bad stuff first. Useful, but what a bummer. The third factor is rumination, our tendency to keep thinking about bad experiences. If you've ever chewed over something in your mind that you did, or that someone did to you, or over something that you don't have but wanted, over and over again, seemingly unable to stop thinking about it, you've experienced what psychologists call rumination. This, quote, "passive comparison of one's current situation with some unachieved standard can manifest in self-critical thoughts such as, why can't I handle things better?" As one study notes, quote, "by reflecting on what went wrong and how to rectify it, people may be able to discover sources of error or alternative strategies, ultimately leading to not repeating mistakes and possibly doing better in the future." It's another potentially useful trait, but boy, can it make us miserable. Boredom, negativity bias, and rumination can each prompt us to distraction. But a fourth factor may be the cruelest of all. Hedonic adaptation. The tendency to quickly return to a baseline level of satisfaction, no matter what happens to us in life, This is Mother Nature's bait and switch. All sorts of life events we think would make us happier actually don't, or at least they don't for very long. For instance, people who have experienced extremely good fortune, such as winning the lottery, have reported that things they had previously enjoyed lost their luster, effectively returning them to their previous levels of satisfaction. As David Myers writes in The Pursuit of Happiness, quote, "Every desirable experience, passionate love, a spiritual high, the pleasure of a new possession, the exhilaration of success, is transitory." Of course, as with the other three factors, there are evolutionary benefits to hedonic adaptation. The author of one study explained that as, quote, "new goals continually capture one's attention, one constantly strives to be happy without realizing that in the long run, such efforts are futile." Oh my God, can we cue the sad trombone music now? Is futility our fate? Absolutely not. As we've learned, dissatisfaction is an innate power that can be channeled to help us make things better in the same way it served our prehistoric relatives. Dissatisfaction and discomfort dominate our brain's default state, but we can use them to motivate us instead of defeat us. Without our species' perpetual disquietude, we would be much worse off, possibly extinct. It's our dissatisfaction that propels us to do everything we do, including to hunt, seek, create, and adapt. Even selfless acts like helping someone are motivated by our need to escape feelings of guilt and injustice. Our insatiable desire to reach for more is what drives us to overturn despots. It's what pushes the invention of world-changing and life-saving technologies, and it's the invisible fuel that drives our ambitions to travel beyond our planet and explore the cosmos. Dissatisfaction is responsible for our species' advancements and its faults. To harness its power, we must disavow the misguided idea that if we're not happy, we're not normal. Exactly the opposite is true. While this shift in mindset can be jarring, it can also be incredibly liberating. It's good to know that feeling bad isn't actually bad. It's exactly what survival of the fittest intended. From that place of acceptance, we stand a chance of avoiding the pitfalls of our psyches. We can recognize pain and rise above it, which is the first step on the road to becoming indistractable. Remember this. Time management is pain management. Distractions cost us time, and like all actions, they are spurred by the desire to escape discomfort. Evolution favored dissatisfaction over contentment. Our tendencies towards boredom, negativity bias, rumination, and hedonic adaptation conspire to make sure we're never satisfied for long. Dissatisfaction is responsible for our species' advancements as much as its faults. It's an innate power that can be channeled to help us make things better. If we want to master distraction, we must learn to deal with discomfort. Chapter 5. Deal with distraction from within. Jonathan Bricker, a psychologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, has spent his career helping people manage the kind of discomfort that not only leads to distraction, but also to disease. His work has been proven to effectively reduce the risk of cancer by changing patient behavior. Bricker writes, quote, "Most people don't think of cancer as a behavioral problem. But whether it's quitting smoking or losing weight or exercising more, there are some definitive things you can do to reduce your risk and thereby live a longer and higher quality life." Bricker's approach involves harnessing the power of imagination to help patients see things differently. His work shows how learning certain techniques as part of acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT for short, can disarm the discomfort that so often leads to harmful distractions. Bricker decided to focus his efforts on smoking cessation and developed an app to deliver ACT over the internet. Though he uses ACT specifically to help people quit smoking, the principles of the program have been shown to effectively reduce many types of urges. At the heart of the therapy is learning to notice and accept one's cravings and to handle them healthfully. Instead of suppressing urges, ACT prescribes a method for stepping back, noticing, observing, and finally letting the desire disappear naturally. But why not simply fight our urges? Why not just say no? It turns out mental abstinence can backfire. Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote in 1863, quote, "Try to pose for yourself this task, not to think of a polar bear, and you will see that the cursed thing will come to mind every minute." 124 years later, the social psychologist Daniel Wagner put Dostoevsky's claim to the test. In a study, participants who were told to avoid thinking of a white bear for 5 minutes did so on average once per minute, just as Dostoevsky predicted. But there was more to Wagner's study. When the same group was told to try and conjure the white bear, they did so much more often than a group who hadn't been asked to suppress the thought. Quote, "The results suggest that suppressing the thought for the first 5 minutes caused it to rebound even more prominently in the participants' minds later, according to an article in Monitor on Psychology." Wagner later dubbed this tendency the ironic process theory, to explain why it's so difficult to tame intruding thoughts. The irony being, of course, that relieving the tension of desire makes something all the more rewarding. An endless cycle of resisting, ruminating, and finally giving in to the desire perpetuates the cycle and quite possibly drives many of our unwanted behaviors. For example, many smokers believe it's the chemical nicotine that causes their cravings. They're certainly not wrong, but they're not completely right either. Nicotine produces distinct physical sensations. However, a fascinating study involving flight attendants demonstrated how even smoking cravings might have much less to do with nicotine than we once thought. Two groups of flight attendants who smoked were sent on two separate flights from Israel. One group was sent on a 3-hour flight to Europe, while the other group traveled to New York, a 10-hour flight. All the smokers were asked by the researchers to rate their level of cravings at set time intervals before, during, and after the flight. If cravings were driven solely by the effect of nicotine on the brain, one would expect that both groups would report strong urges after the same number of minutes had elapsed since their last cigarette. The more time passed, the more their brains would chemically crave nicotine. But that's not what happened. When the flight attendants flying to New York were above the Atlantic Ocean, they reported weak cravings. Meanwhile, at the exact same moment, the cravings of their colleagues who had just landed in Europe were at their strongest. What was going on? The New York-bound flight attendants knew they could not smoke in the middle of their flight without being fired. Only later, when they approached their destination, did they report the greatest desire to smoke. It appeared the duration of the trip and the time since their last cigarette didn't affect the level of the flight attendants' cravings. What affected their desire was not how much time had passed after a smoke, but how much time was left before they could smoke again. If, as this study suggests, a craving for something as addictive as nicotine can be manipulated in this way, why can't we trick our brains into mastering other unhealthy desires? Thankfully, we can. You'll notice that throughout this audiobook, I cite smoking cessation and drug addiction research. I do this for two reasons. First, though studies show very few people are pathologically addicted to distractions like the internet, tech overuse can look to many like an addiction. Second, I wanted to make the point that if these well-established techniques are effective at stopping physical dependencies to nicotine and other substances, then they can certainly help us control cravings for distraction. After all, we're not injecting Instagram or freebasing Facebook. Certain desires can be modulated, if not completely mitigated, by how we think about our urges. In the following chapters, we'll learn how to think differently about three things: the internal trigger, the task, and our temperament. Remember this. Without techniques for disarming temptation, mental abstinence can backfire. Resisting an urge can trigger rumination and make the desire grow stronger. It can manage distractions that originate from within by changing how we think about them. We can reimagine the trigger, the task, and our temperament. Chapter 6. Reimagine the internal trigger. While we can't control the feelings and thoughts that pop into our heads, we can control what we do with them. Bricker's work using acceptance and commitment therapy and smoking cessation programs suggests we shouldn't keep telling ourselves to stop thinking about an urge. Instead, we must learn better ways to cope. The same applies to other distractions like checking our phones too much, eating junk food, or excessive shopping. Rather than trying to fight the urge, we need new methods to handle intrusive thoughts. The following four steps help us do just that. Step 1. Look for the discomfort that precedes the distraction, focusing on the internal trigger. A common problem I have while writing is the urge to Google something. It's easy to justify this bad habit as just doing some research, but deep down I know it's often just a diversion from difficult work. Bricker advises focusing on the internal trigger that precedes the unwanted behavior, like feeling anxious, having a craving, feeling restless, or thinking you're incompetent. Step 2. Write down the trigger. Bricker advises writing down the trigger, whether or not you subsequently give in to the distraction. He recommends noting the time of day, what you were doing, and how you felt when you noticed the internal trigger that led to the distracting behavior. Quote, as soon as you are aware of the behavior, because it's easier at that point to remember how you felt. When you get a chance, make sure you go to indistractable.com and download the free distraction tracker. You can use it to note these sensations whenever they arise. According to Bricker, while people can easily identify the external trigger, quote, it takes some time and trials to begin noticing those all-important inside triggers. He recommends discussing the urge as if you were an observer, telling yourself something like, quote, I'm feeling this tension in my chest right now, and there I go, trying to reach for my iPhone. The better we are at noticing the behavior, the better we'll be at managing it over time. He says, the anxiety goes away, the thought gets weaker, and is replaced by another thought. Step 3. Explore your sensations. Bricker then recommends getting curious about that sensation. For example, do your fingers twitch when you're about to be distracted? Do you get a flurry of butterflies in your stomach when you think about work when you're with your kids? What does it feel like when the feelings crest and then subside? Bricker encourages staying with the feeling before acting on the impulse. When similar techniques were applied in a smoking cessation study, the participants who learned to acknowledge and explore their cravings managed to quit at double the rate of those in the American Lung Association's best performing cessation program. One of Bricker's favorite techniques is what he calls the leaves on a stream method. When feeling the uncomfortable internal trigger to do something you'd rather not, he says, imagine you are seated beside a gently flowing stream. Then, imagine there are leaves floating down that stream. Place each thought in your mind on each leaf. It could be a memory, a word, a worry, or an image, and let each of those leaves float down that stream, swirling away as you sit and just watch. Step 4. Beware of liminal moments. Liminal moments are transitions from one thing to another throughout our days. Have you ever picked up your phone while waiting for a traffic light to change, then found yourself still looking at your phone while driving? Or opened a tab on your web browser, got annoyed by how long it's taking to load, and opened up another page while you were waiting? Or looked at a social media app while walking from one meeting to the next, only to keep scrolling when you got back to your desk? There's nothing wrong with any of these actions per se. Rather, what's dangerous is that by doing them just for a sec, we're likely to do things we later regret, like getting off track for half an hour or getting into a car accident. A technique I found particularly helpful for dealing with this distraction trap is the 10-minute rule. If I find myself wanting to check my phone as a pacification device when I can't think of anything better to do, I tell myself it's fine to give in, but not right now. I have to wait just 10 minutes. This technique is effective at helping me deal with all sorts of potential distractions, like Googling something rather than writing, eating something unhealthy when I'm bored, or watching another episode of Netflix when I'm too tired to go to bed. This rule allows time to do what some behavioral psychologists call surfing the urge. When an urge takes hold, noticing the sensations and riding them like a wave, neither pushing them away nor acting on them, helps us cope until the feelings subside. Surfing the urge, along with other techniques to bring attention to the craving, has been shown to reduce the number of cigarettes smokers consumed when compared to those in a control group who didn't use the technique. If we still want to perform the action after 10 minutes of urge surfing, we're free to do it. But that's rarely still the case. The liminal moment has passed, and we're able to do the thing we really wanted to do. Techniques like surfing the urge and thinking of our cravings as leaves on a stream are mental skill-building exercises that can help us stop impulsively giving in to our distractions. They recondition our minds to seek relief from internal triggers in a reflective rather than a reactive way. As Oliver Berkman wrote in The Guardian, quote, "It's a curious truth that when you gently pay attention to negative emotions, they tend to dissipate, but positive ones expand." We've considered how we might reimagine our internal triggers. Next, we'll learn how to reimagine the tasks we're trying to stay focused on. Remember this. By reimagining an uncomfortable internal trigger, we can disarm it. Step 1. Look for the emotion preceding distraction. Step 2. Write down the internal trigger using your distraction tracker. Step 3. Explore the negative sensation with curiosity instead of contempt. And step 4. Be extra cautious during liminal moments. Chapter 7. Reimagine the task. Ian Bogos studies fun for a living. A professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology, Bogos has written 10 books, including quirky titles like How to Talk About Video Games, The Geek's Chihuahua, and most recently, Play Anything. In his latest book, Bogos makes several bold claims that challenge the way we think about fun and play. Fun, he writes, turns out to be fun even if it doesn't involve much or any enjoyment. Huh? Doesn't fun have to feel good? Not necessarily, Bogos says. By relinquishing our notions about what fun should feel like, we open ourselves up to seeing tasks in a whole new way. He advises that play can be part of any difficult task, and though play doesn't necessarily have to be pleasurable, it can free us from discomfort, which, let's not forget, is the central ingredient driving distraction. Given what we know about our propensity for distraction when we're uncomfortable, reimagining difficult work as fun could prove incredibly empowering. Imagine how powerful you'd feel if you were able to transform the hard, focused work you have to do into something that felt like play. Is that even possible? Bogos thinks it is, but probably not in the way you think. Fun and play don't have to make us feel good per se. Rather, they can be used as tools to keep us focused. We've all heard Mary Poppins' advice to add a spoonful of sugar to turn a job into a game, yes? Well, Bogos believes that Poppins was wrong. He claims her approach, quote, recommends covering over drudgery. As he writes, quote, "We fail to have fun because we don't take things seriously enough, not because we take them so seriously that we'd have to cut their bitter taste with sugar. Fun is not a feeling so much as an exhaust produced when an operator can treat something with dignity." Bogos tells us that fun is the aftermath of deliberately manipulating a familiar situation in a new way. The answer, therefore, is to focus on the task itself. Instead of running away from our pain or using rewards like prizes and treats to help motivate us, the idea is to pay such close attention that you find new challenges where you didn't see them before. Those new challenges provide the novelty to engage our attention and maintain focus when tempted by distraction. Countless commercially produced distractions like television or social media use slot machine-like variable rewards to keep us engaged with a constant stream of newness. But Bogos points out that we can use the same techniques to make any task more pleasurable and compelling. We can use the same neural hardwiring that keeps us hooked to media to keep us engaged with an otherwise unpleasant task. Bogos gives the example of mowing his lawn. Quote, "It may seem ridiculous to call an activity like this fun," he writes, "and yet he learned to love it." Here's how. Quote, "First, pay close, foolish, even absurd attention to things." For Bogos, he soaked up as much information as he could about the way grass grows and how to treat it. Then he created a, quote, "imaginary playground" in which the limitations actually helped to produce meaningful experiences. He learned about the constraints he had to operate under, including his local weather conditions and what different kinds of equipment can and can't do. Operating under constraints, Bogos says, is the key to creativity and fun. Finding the optimal path for the mower or beating a record time are other ways to create an imaginary playground. While learning how to have fun cutting grass may seem like a stretch, people find fun in a wide range of activities that you might not find particularly interesting. Consider my local coffee-obsessed barista who spends a ridiculous amount of time refining the perfect brew. The car buff who toils for countless hours fine-tuning his ride. Or the crafter who painstakingly produces intricate sweaters and quilts for everyone she knows.
If people can have fun doing these activities by choice, what's so crazy about bringing the same kind of mindset to other tasks? For me, I learned to stay focused on the tedious work of writing books by finding the mystery in the work. I write to answer interesting questions and discover novel solutions to old problems. To use a popular aphorism, the cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity. Today, I write for the fun of it. Of course, it's also my profession. But by finding the fun, I'm able to do my work without getting as distracted as I once did. Fun is looking for the variability in something other people don't notice. It's breaking through the boredom and monotony to discover its hidden beauty. The great thinkers and tinkerers of history made their discoveries because they were obsessed with the intoxicating draw of discovery. The mystery that pulls us in because we want to know more. But remember, finding novelty is only possible when we give ourselves the time to focus intently on a task and look hard for the variability. Whether it's uncertainty about our ability to do a task better or faster than last time, or coming back to challenge the unknown day after day, the quest to solve these mysteries is what turns the discomfort we seek to escape with distraction into an activity we embrace. The last step in managing the internal triggers that can lead to distraction is to reimagine our capabilities. We'll start by shattering a common self-defeating belief many of us tell ourselves daily. Remember this. We can master internal triggers by reimagining an otherwise dreary task. Fun and play can be used as tools to keep us focused. Play doesn't have to be pleasurable. It just has to hold our attention. Deliberateness and novelty can be added to any task to make it fun. Chapter 8. Reimagine your temperament. To manage the discomfort that tugs us towards distraction, we need to think of ourselves differently. The way we perceive our temperament, which is defined as a person's or animal's nature, especially as it permanently affects their behavior, has a profound impact on how we behave. One of the most pervasive bits of folk psychology is the belief that self-control is limited, that by the nature of our temperament, we only have so much willpower available to us. Furthermore, the thinking goes, we are liable to run out of willpower when we exert ourselves. Psychologists have a name for this phenomenon, ego depletion. Not so long ago, my after-work routine looked like this. I'd sit on the couch, and I'd veg out for hours, keeping company with Netflix and a cold pint of ice cream. Ben and Jerry's chocolate fudge brownie, to be exact. I knew the ice cream and the sitting weren't good for me, but I justified my actions by telling myself I was spent, acting as if my ego were depleted, even if I'd never heard the term. This theory would seem to perfectly explain my after-work indulgences. But is ego depletion real? In 2011, the psychologist Roy Baumeister wrote the bestseller Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength with New York Times journalist John Tierney. The book cited several of Baumeister's studies demonstrating the ego depletion theory, including one notable experiment that showed a seemingly miraculous way to restore willpower, consuming sugar. The study claimed that participants who had sipped sugar-sweetened lemonade